This is day four of this July 2014 seven-day session. I'll resume reading from the teachings of Japanese Zen master Bankei, and this is the book we're using is Bankei Zen by Peter Haskell. So Bankei is in his talks during this three-month retreat. When it comes to the idea of being free in birth and death, people are apt to misunderstand. There are some who announce beforehand they're going to die in a certain number of days, while others go so far as to express their intention to die, say, next year, in such and such a month, and on such and such a day. When the time arrives, some of them, even though they're not ill, die just as they said, while others put it off for another day or a month and then pass away. Evidently, this is true. There were people who did this. There are lots of people who consider this being free in birth and death. But things of this sort are only a result of the strength of people's ascetic practices, and often they haven't opened the eye of the way. While they may know the time of their death, they haven't yet opened the eye of the way, and that's why I don't accept this kind of thing. The person of the unborn transcends birth and death. And again, here we have the standard Zen dismissal of psychic powers as, at least dismissing them as compared to really seeing into one's true nature. There's a koan in the collection of koans called the Shoyo Roku, the Book of Equanimity, in which a certain monk disputes the sanctioning of another, and the one who whose sanctioning is called into question says, well, if I can die within the time it takes for this stick of incense to burn down, then that will show you, or something like that. And he does. He dies in the time of the stick of incense burns down. And I'm forgetting the punchline because I just thought of this koan. The other one tenderly says to him after he's died, sort of touches him and says, "That's not it. It's not it." By the way. Now, I'm sure you're all wondering just what it means to transcend birth and death. That which is unborn is imperishable, and since what doesn't perish doesn't die, it transcends birth and death. So what I call one who's free in birth and death is one who dies unconcerned with birth and death. What's more, the matter of birth and death is something that's with us all day. It doesn't mean only once in a lifetime when we confront the moment of death itself. One who's free in birth and death is one who always remains unconcerned with birth and death, knowing that so long as we're allowed to live, we live. And when the time comes to die, even if death comes right now, we just die, realizing that when we die isn't of great importance. Such a person is also one who has conclusively realized the marvelously illuminating unborn Buddha mind. Talking and thinking about something like an hour of what day you're going to die is really narrow-minded, don't you think? This is what I think the Japanese would call bonpu zen, this ability to control one's body mind to such an extent that you could do this. This is discussed in the Three Pillars of Zen. Basically, bonpu zen is zen practiced to develop mental powers and also to develop one's and improve one's physical health. It's a pale shadow of the real promise of Zen practice, which is to see through body-mind. Not to develop greater powers. This is the hardest thing for us to sink in for us is so difficult when we hear birth and death. I think most everyone thinks about what does we conventionally mean by death after 80 or 90 years or whatever, and birth when we come out of the birth canal. But that's just one type of birth and death. The other is, as he says, is what we sometimes call continuous birth and death. Since we all recited the Hakuin chant a few minutes ago, we've all died and been reborn in a very real way. This isn't just metaphorical or abstract. Our bodily mental processes are in flux, and there is no the people who recited the Hakuin chant are no longer with us. This is tremendously encouraging. It means that we're not stuck with a self. We are fluid. We can remake ourselves moment after moment. And we get a chance moment after moment, breath after breath, in how we choose to direct our attention. There it is. That's whether we are remaking ourselves or not. If we choose to dwell in our thoughts, then that'll be one kind of outcome. And if instead we return our attention to this realm of no thought, which is another word for the unborn, our true nature, mu, then that is something entirely different. The Buddha spoke of four kinds of adversities. Not getting what you want, getting what you don't want, being separated from those you want to be with, and having to be with those you don't want to be with. In each of these moments, or each of these times, each of these can be called a kind of death we're facing, and we have the choice there of moving along with the situation, becoming one with the situation, or not, which means fleeing into our thoughts and our notions about what we'd rather be doing or whom we'd rather be with. That's the training. We have opportunities for training wherever we are. We don't have to be in the Zendo. We don't have to be sitting at home. We're facing opportunities for dying all the time. Basically, it means letting go or not letting go. Letting go and letting things be or not. Another way to understand it is whether or not we cling to our thoughts or let go. And the practice, this is all practice. It's not just practice in being able, when we're 85, to die a more peaceful death. It's infinitely more important than that, because it's practice in living. It's the same secret to living and dying, letting go, not clinging, not attaching to the phenomena of the mind or body. This is a really good passage. The reason people misunderstand the difference between thoughts and delusions is that everyone imagines thoughts all exist at the bottom and arise from there. But originally, there's no actual substance at the bottom from which thoughts arise. I have to admit, I often visualized it that way, just automatically, sort of half-consciously, like the sediment at the bottom of the ocean. There's no actual substance at the bottom from which thoughts arise, which means there's also no bottom. Instead, you retain the things you see and hear, and from time to time, in response to circumstances, the impressions created by these experiences are reflected back to you in precise detail. So when they're reflected, just let them be and refrain from attaching to them. Even if evil thoughts come up, just let them come up. Don't involve yourself with them, and they can't help but stop. Isn't this just the same as if they didn't arise? That way, there won't be any evil thoughts for you to drive out forcefully, or any remorse about having had them. This is such a vital point he's making. He's putting in very plain, simple language that the Buddhist teaching of the storehouse consciousness, that this is Buddhist psychology 101, that everything we see and everything we hear, everything we smell, everything we taste, and everything we feel, and everything we think is filed away in this storehouse consciousness called the Alaya Vijnana. And then, as he says, in response to circumstances and conditions, these seeds of perception, thought perceptions, sights, sounds, and so forth, these seeds that have been planted in the mind, as it were, come back, can bubble up or to come up to consciousness. This is they're reflected back to you in precise detail. I know from Doksan that many people have the experience during Sesshin of mining deeper layers of the mind, or having primitive material bubble up into the mind, things we haven't thought about for years, experiences from long ago, memories from long ago, memories from nowhere we can remember, just stuff that comes up in the mind. Faces, clear faces that we've never seen, and dreams. Sesshin seems to open up channels of dream material that can be fascinating, it can be horrifying. Violent dreams, depraved dreams, all kinds of things. People sometimes find these images very unsettling, but they needn't. It's just, I always think of it as like a flushing out process that is the nature of sesshin. We're excavating, or flushing. You can think of it in a couple ways. The obvious way that we use toilets every day, or just getting into the brambles and having flushing out quail or other birds. But this, I believe, is just what Bankei is talking about. Even if evil thoughts come up, just let them come up. Don't involve yourself with them. People can waste so much time drawing conclusions because of some macabre dream they had or violent dream, when it's no, why? There's no reason to analyze it or blame yourself for it, think that it reflects something about your character. It's just garbage that's floating up to the surface. But leave it alone. And then, over time, the material just stops coming up, or certainly much less of it. It gets exhausted. He continues, because the Buddha mind is marvelously illuminating, mental impressions from the past are reflected, and you make the mistake of labeling as delusions things that aren't delusions at all. Delusions means the anguish of thought feeding on thought. What foolishness it is to create the anguish of delusion by changing the precious Buddha mind, pondering over this and that, mulling over things of no worth. If there were anyone who actually succeeded at something by pondering it all the way through, it might be all right to do things that way. But I've never heard of anyone who, in the end, was able to accomplish anything like this. So, pondering over things is useless, isn't it? It's utterly useless. Well, he would acknowledge that there are times when we have to solve a particular problem, some practical thing, that we have to bring our thinking mind to bear on it. But what he's talking about is far more common, just ruminating, trying to figure something out, dwelling on something that's happened and trying to understand it conceptually, or anticipating something that might happen and playing out the various scenarios in one's mind, second-guessing oneself. Woulda, coulda, shoulda. These are utterly a waste of time. Delusions means the anguish of thought feeding on thought. So what I believe he's saying here is, of course, that thoughts arise in the mind all the time. Those aren't delusions. They're thoughts, just neuronal traces, electrical traces flickering in the mind. Those aren't delusions. It's just what a brain does. A brain generates thought activity just as the stomach generates gastric juices. It's sort of its job. It's on its job assignment, is to create thought activity. So a living brain does that just naturally. And we need to accept that there's going to be some degree of thought activity in the mind as we're sitting. There's no harm in that. Delusions, he's saying, are when we start thinking about the thoughts and start making something of them. Maybe you could say that delusions are more like the neuroses that develop by our cogitating about things and making them about the self. Regrets, you could call delusion, hopes. So when they're reflected, referring to thoughts, when they're reflected, he says, just let them be and refrain from attaching to them. So surely everyone understands this distinction between just the natural thought activity that's going on all the time and then the mistake of making something of all that and whipping up some witch's brew of self-concern. But it's so difficult not to do it because of our habit of making something of our thoughts and whipping up a witch's brew of self-concern. So we have the chance again and again to refrain from doing the latter. This is how we eventually dissolve that very strong habit force of making something of thoughts when there's nothing there, just by repetition, by persistently catching ourselves, noticing when we're making something of thoughts and just dropping it, going back to the practice. That's the meat and potatoes of Zen practice, over again and over and over and over, over dozens of times, hundreds of times, thousands of times, tens of thousands of times, catching ourselves doing that and then returning our attention to the practice. That's how we remake ourselves. That's how we become free of these karmic obstructions that develop just through repetition. If they develop through repetition, we can deconstruct them through persistent zazen. Anything that's constructed can be deconstructed. These things are not in our nature. These delusions are not in our essential nature. We've crafted them over years or lifetimes, and then we can take them apart. Here's another one. I tell my students and those of you coming regularly here to the temple, be stupid. Because you've got the dynamic function of the marvelously illuminating Buddha mind, even if you get rid of discriminative understanding, you won't be foolish. He's distinguishing here between stupid and foolish. So all of you, from here on, be stupid. Even if you're stupid, when you're hungry, you'll ask for something to eat. When you're thirsty, you'll ask for some tea. When it gets warm, you'll put on thin, light clothes. And when it's cold, you'll put on more clothes. As far as your activities of today are concerned, you're not lacking a thing. So, stupid, I don't care that much for that that translation. Who knows what he said in the Japanese, original Japanese. I think a better one that doesn't carry the kind of freight that the word stupid does is be simple. That's another translation I've seen, or be ordinary, but simple. Simple is a great word, a great thing to aspire to. It's a gift to be simple. It's a gift to be free. And they go together. If we're not weaving problems that don't need to be there, if we can just respond as called for and not complicate things, that's really what he's saying. And this is one of the guaranteed developments in the course of a sesshin, is that we become simpler. Everything becomes simpler because we are everything. And as the mind gets simplified over the course of a sesshin, everything else becomes simpler, because everything is our mind. Everything is mind. This is the genius of meditation. By altering the mind, by letting thoughts settle, and having the mind become more simple in its responses, everything becomes simpler. He continues, with people who are clever, there are sure to be a great many shortcomings. Clever is kind of more the British word for smart, or we can even think about high IQ. I think it's fair to substitute that, but let's say smart. It's a word that is in currency a lot more here than clever. With people who are smart, there are sure to be a great many shortcomings. To have transcended those smart people whom all the world holds in great esteem is what's meant by stupidity. There's really nothing wrong with being a blockhead. When people say that someone is a smart fellow, I ask to meet him. And when I do and we have a chance to talk, it looks to me as if people in the world are praising an awful lot of foolishness. I'm suddenly remembering Harada Roshi, who used to say, philosophy is the study of human delusion. And he had been a philosophy professor. I take that to mean philosophy is just playing with concepts. Not that it doesn't have its place. I really got onto Zen through a philosophy course, so it definitely has a place. And it's a way to begin facing basic human predicaments and dilemmas and thinking about major things. But it goes back to what Bankei was just saying. I've never met anyone who could, figure out. Pondering is utterly useless. In philosophy, it's pondering. That is, in the usual meaning of the word, the original meaning of philosophy is the truth. Seeking the truth. As a philosopher is one who seeks the truth. but mostly it means people who engage with their conceptual minds. So, okay, it seems to me as if people in the world are praising an awful lot of foolishness. The fact is that those clever people acclaimed by the world are, from the start, deluded by their own cleverness. They distort the Buddha mind and obscure its marvelously illuminating dynamic function, considering other people as of no account, contradicting whatever they say, slighting and insulting them. Of course, since those they're insulting are also amply endowed with a marvelously illuminating Buddha mind, they aren't going to let themselves be slighted like that, so they get angry and answer right back, heedlessly pouring forth abuse. The true person's ideal is to show kindness to those who are foolish and help those who are evil. To be recognized as a good man by the people of the world is precisely what makes being born a human being worthwhile. How can it be any good to earn yourself the reputation of a wicked person? I think he's also talking here about people who are skilled at a repartee or debate. People, you see, very many people. Our society rewards people who have verbal facility, who are very good at using words and concepts skillfully to present their own opinions and their way of their own views. And such people have a kind of a can be impressive to those who don't know any better, who are impressed by the uses of the intellect. But the intellect is such a small, little, puny segment of the mind. Yasutani Roshi, I'm told, would sometimes at his introductory workshops would hold up a pen, a ballpoint pen, and say, if this is your true mind, the intellect is no more than the tip, the ball at the end of the pen. Our society rewards, financially rewards people who are smart. But there's so much suffering created by people who are smart. So when you go back to your homes and meet your old acquaintances, you should have them wondering about you all. How did Bankei teach them Buddhism anyway? Why, they've come back even more stupid than before they left. What I'm talking about isn't the stupidity of stupidity and understanding. That which transcends stupidity and understanding is what I mean by stupidity. Another time, a monk questioned the master, "What is enlightenment?" The master replied, "There's no such thing as enlightenment. It's a completely extraneous pursuit. To realize conclusively that the Buddha mind you have from your parents innately is unborn and marvelously illuminating, that's enlightenment. Not realizing this makes you deluded. Of course, when he says there's no such thing as enlightenment, he's not saying there is no such experience, because right after he says that, he talks about that experience. He's saying, stop looking for a thing, some object, apart from you in the future, that you call enlightenment. It's your own mind. But he continues, since the original Buddha mind is unborn, it functions without thoughts of delusion or thoughts of wanting to be enlightened. As soon as you think of wanting to be enlightened, you leave the place of the unborn and go counter to it. Because the Buddha mind is unborn, it has no thoughts at all. Thoughts are the source of delusion. That is, attaching to thoughts. We just went through that. It's not the thoughts themselves, but what we do with them or don't do with them that determines whether they become delusions. Thoughts are the source of delusion. When thoughts are gone, delusions vanish too. And once you've stopped being deluded, talking about wanting to attain enlightenment, in quotations, certainly is useless. Don't you agree? Monk asked, I find it impossible to suppress all my defilements and delusions. I hope everyone knows the mistake this monk is making. I find it impossible to suppress all my defilements and delusions. What can I do to suppress them? The master replied, trying to suppress delusion is delusion too. Delusions have no original existence. They're only things you create yourself by indulging in discrimination. So a thought arises, discrimination, a thought arises. And then either we just swing our attention back to the practice, or we somehow make something of the thought, bad thought, good thought, bad self for having thoughts. That's the discriminating that just creates misery for us. A nun from Izumo asked, both my parents are still living. How should I observe my filial duty toward them? Just a comment. It's hard for us as Westerners to appreciate the significance, the importance to Chinese, Japanese, Koreans of this matter of filial duty, which is at the core of the Confucian ethos. But this is a huge, huge thing. How should I observe my filial duty toward them? The master replied, there's no particular manner in which one must express filiality. Simply abiding in the Buddha mind you have from your parents innately, just as it is. This is the true practice of filiality. Failing to do this is what it means to be unfilial. Remember struggling with my thoughts about my mother when I was early in practice working on Mu and starting to expose all kinds of deep-seated issues with my mother in particular, and going to Doksan with Roshi, and I would probably the only time I ever brought up a personal thing with him, but it was so, maybe I was sobbing or something at the time, and he said, your sitting here in Sesshin is offering great help to your mother. And I remember the time wanting to believe it, not so sure, but there's no question that we are helping our mothers and our fathers, along with numberless other beings, just in sitting, turning the mind back again and again to our practice. There is no question. Mind is unlimited, boundless. This practice is not just for ourselves. It's not even just for others after Sesshin, when we return to the world and are more aware and attuned to others and responsive and helpful. It's right here. We are broadcasting stations, reaching beings everywhere. If we're sitting and just dwelling in our thoughts, well, it's not the same thing. But making the sincere effort over and over again to return to this realm of no thought that we call the breath, mu, what is it, who is it, shikantaza, to keep returning to that realm, detaching from thoughts and returning to the realm of no thought, this is the most powerful force for helping others. A totally different order than anything else we might do for our parents or anyone else. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.